We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Muse, the brain sensing headband that helps you build or deepen your meditation practice and keep your brain healthy, and Meditation Studio, the 5-star app. I'm Patricia Karpus. Don't forget to access the Meditation Studio meditations now for free at choosemuse.com/meditationstudio. Whatever your favorite form of meditation, a good guided meditation every once in a while is just great inspiration. That's at choosemuse.com/meditationstudio. Today's guest is Hirsch Wilson, an interesting guy with many passions, but none more important than being with and learning from the dogs in his life. His new book, Dog Lessons, Learning the Important Stuff from Our Best Friends, is proof of the powerful presence of dogs in our lives and the transformative lessons they can teach us about love, loyalty, grief, and more. Along the way, he was also a volunteer firefighter and wrote an award-winning book called Firefighter Zen, a field guide for thriving in tough times. He considers dog lessons, though, a meditation on the truths dogs can teach us, from universal values like loyalty and curiosity to practical lessons on napping, playing, and avoiding a serious fight. It's all pretty darn good advice. One of his big messages is that dogs help us remember that life is short and we must celebrate it wherever we can. They often help us find refuge, quiet, and peace in this very complicated world. This is a bit different from our usual Untangle interviews, but I couldn't resist since I'm a dog person myself and living with the love and challenges that come with my little pup. Now, here's Hirsch. Good morning, Hirsch. It's great to have you on our show today. Thanks for being here.
I'm excited to be here and talk about dogs, my favorite topic.
Yeah, my favorite topic too, other than meditation and mindfulness and brain science and all the other things we love to talk about. But we have never talked about dogs on our show. And when I think it was your publicist reached out, I just looked at the title of the book and I was like, yes, we need that. So I'm super excited about talking to you about your experience with dogs. I like that you named your book Dog Lessons, because we're going to talk today about all the things that we learn from our dogs about how to be a human being in this complex world we live in.
There's a lot to learn from dogs on that topic.
Good. Tell me a little bit about your first experience with dogs. How did you begin to love them?
So I was the oldest of six. And at the time, it was me and then there were four daughters. So I spent a lot of time alone in my room. We had just moved from the suburbs of Minneapolis, where I was a pretty happy kid. We played capture the flag in our neighborhood and we would chase the DDT trucks as they sprayed mosquitoes and we just run in and out of the smoke. Better living through chemistry. And then at some point, my dad had had enough of the suburbs because he was getting too involved in politics. So we moved out to this lovely, lovely place called Eden Prairie, Minnesota, on the bluffs of the Minnesota River. And my dad traveled a lot. So at some point, my mom came up to my room because she was managing the family, which was just chaos, and said, you know what we need? We need a dog. And a couple weeks later, we went out to this farm that raised German shepherds. And my experience with dogs previously had been in our old neighborhood, I'd been attacked by two dogs standing for the bus waiting for school. So I was trepidatious, but I walked into that barn and I heard all these 8-week-old puppies just howling and barking and whining. And I was just entranced. And the owner, the guardian of the female German Shepherd said, "Would you like to go in and meet the puppies?" So she opened the gate and I just dove in and was surrounded by, climbed on top of by German Shepherd puppies. It was one of the most memorable experiences of my life. And we picked out a female and we brought her home. And driving up our long gravelly driveway, she threw up in my shoes, which is my introduction to the other part of dog ownership. We named her Shawnee. And at the time, my parents were young. They're in their late 20s. And they were in over their heads. And we had no idea. We did no reading. We did no research. We had no idea how to raise a dog. So Shawnee basically had the run of the household. She was an indoor-outdoor dog, as comfortable sleeping out in a snowdrift as sleeping in one of the beds of my sister's. But it was just a remarkable experience. It absolutely changed my personality. I spent much less time in my room, and we spent much more time exploring the river bottoms of the Minnesota River, just me and Shawnee. So it was a fundamentally transformative experience.
It's interesting because you say this in your book too, and I think it's with your current dogs, you don't do a lot of training and you let them have the run of the house. And you told me Maisie, your dog that's sitting under your chair right now, is the alpha in the house and she's the smallest. Do you think that's okay with some dogs, but not with others?
I make a point in the book. It's not so much about breeds. It's about the individual dog. Every dog is different. And I think our other point is we want our dogs to be dogs, to not be little people or not be toys, but to be able to fully express themselves as dogs. And so that means dogs bark, dogs tug on leashes. Dogs want to be with us. So they climb up on couches, they climb up on beds. And I make the point early on in the book that this is how we let our dogs basically be anywhere they want to be. Now, the things that we train them to do, of course, they're all house trained. We work hard on them being calm on walks and being socialized. But other than that, we're pretty lax.
Yeah. And you trained Shawnee to be your companion as a young boy that spent a lot of time alone. Is that how that started?
Absolutely. And I owe a lot of this to my mom. My mom first taught me to learn everything there was about the Minnesota River, the indigenous people that lived there, the Scandinavians and Germans that came there. And once I knew all that, she gave me permission to take my dog, Shawnee, down to the river bluffs. We'd spend days down by the river together, just Shawnee and I. And it was Tom Sawyer, Huck Finn childhood. One of the sad things about life today is that our kids don't have that kind of experience. We're much more protective. We are as parents. I have two daughters. So we are much more protective as parents than my parents were. And the good side about that, I had a lot of freedom to just be out in the wilderness with the dog.
That's such a wonderful way to grow up. And when you started thinking about writing this book, so this is years later, so that was your beginning with dogs, and then you had dogs ever since, and then you married a woman who loves dogs, and your children love dogs, and this is your family tradition. What inspired you to actually write this book, and what are you hoping to convey to people, and to dog owners and dog lovers, dog guardians?
It just occurred to me one day, I was writing another book about being a firefighter, and my dogs were curled around at my feet and just hanging out. And I just realized that they were incredibly special beings. They always wanted to be with me. They were relaxed in ways that I could not relax. And I thought that I might have been taking them for granted. And that stunned me because I've had dogs all my life. And so I really wanted to explore what it meant to be a dog guardian. And I'm not a dog trainer. I'm not a dog cognitive scientist. I'm just somebody who has been with dogs all my life. And I wanted to really explore what that meant, what I'd learned. And in talking to our publisher at New World Libraries, he said, what you're really talking about is not about how to train dogs, but how dogs have trained and given us experience and lessons.
It's so interesting that you flip it. What are the lessons that dogs have given us? And I love that. And I want to go through some of these lessons. But I've had this experience recently because I have a little dog who's quite anxious, and I live in a place that has an elevator in a condo. And he hates the elevators, and he every once in a while gets a little nervous in there. And so I have learned that I have to slow down and slow his mindset and calm him as we're walking into the elevator, as we're walking out of the elevator, and then when we walk down the street and see other dogs. But it's been a really interesting journey for me to learn from him to slow down and notice and try to protect him or keep him safe from his own anxiety. So I was just super curious about that. What are these lessons that dogs teach us? And are we noticing them all the time? Or are we just expecting our dogs to be our little companion? So yeah, let's go through some of the lessons that you've learned. I think one of the first ones, and if any of this, by the way, ties into some of your experiences as a firefighter, I found that fascinating as well. But the first of the dog lessons I think you talked about was freedom and that dynamic between freedom and safety, adventure, and playing it safe. What is that lesson?
I take, for example, our current Great Pyrenees, Toby. So he was a rescue and he was in the shelter and he had been returned to the shelter 3 times before we got him. And part of the reason was Toby did not like to be locked up. One of the first families that tried to own him kept him in a crate and he broke out of the crate. Then he broke out of the house. And I was curious about why a dog does that. We've had dogs that have gone through screens to get outside, jumped over fences to get outside. And I always wondered, what was that urge? What were they trying to accomplish? And Toby once got out of our house and he went exploring, went around the neighborhood. We live in the Pinon Juniper Forest, so he explored there, but he ultimately came back. I thought there's something in a dog that wants to be free, doesn't want to be leashed, doesn't want to be enclosed in a fence yard, definitely doesn't want to be in a crate, but wants to be free. I thought about that a lot because our impulse is we put them on leashes and harnesses and we fence them in to keep them safe because we know that a bad encounter with a car, a bad encounter with another dog can be dangerous. It occurred to me that that defines our lives in so many ways, that we want to be safe, but we want to be free. And sometimes freedom comes at a cost. We have to understand and do the risk calculations in our heads. It starts with the question, what are our lives about? Are our lives about being fenced in? Are our lives about being contained? Or are we here to really explore freedom and understand what it means to be free, understand what it means to explore and be willing to take the risks? Toby's urge to get outside, to jump over fences is kind of metaphor for us for that.
Yeah, you said you don't think dogs do that calculus. Should I, or shouldn't I? And you're like, we, on the other hand, as overthinkers, are often caught up in this problem. Shall I go for it? Shall I stay inside my fence? Do I want to be constrained? Or do I want to be my true free self?
That's the question that faces us every day. And it doesn't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter what you've accomplished in your life. It's always about pushing those boundaries and being uncomfortable.
Well, you also said you learned sometimes as you grew up, you said near the river and the woods and with your dogs. And if you ever wandered too far away from the woods or the river or the dogs, which you felt you had, you felt adrift. And even now, sometimes when you feel disconnected or you're not sure where you fit, you go back to that, I guess, mantra, woods, river, dog. How does that sync with your ideas of freedom? Or is that what gives you your ground in order to feel like you can do what you want to do?
At a simple level, if I'm not outside every day, I'm not a good person. I desire to be in the wilderness. I desire to be outside. In Minnesota, it was in the prairies and the river bottoms. And here in Santa Fe, New Mexico, it's in the mountains. The most contemplative, peaceful experiences I have are when I'm with our dogs alone in the mountains. And Mary Oliver, who's this great poet, talks about when she goes into the woods, she goes alone because she's hugging trees and talking to the birds and she doesn't want other people to see that. And that's when she felt most unbounded. That resonates with me. It's where I feel the most creative, the most peaceful, and free is when I'm outside in the wilderness with dogs.
Another lesson is wild at heart, and that syncs with what you're saying about we have these wild roots, these instincts, needs, and behaviors. And so the more our culture, you say, strongly pushes back on that. And why do you think that is, or where do you feel that push the most?
it starts with stepping back and understand who we are as human beings and coming from an evolutionary perspective. And that is that our grounding, who we are as animals, as Homo sapiens, came from being hunter-gatherers for millions of years. And civilization, we've only had agriculture for what, 4,000 years? And cities for fewer thousand years than that. And that's just a veneer, a thin icing on the cake of who we deeply are. I can't remember who wrote the book about evolutionary psychology, but he talked about one of the saddest things to see is a man standing on a subway platform in a crowd of strangers, you're trying to go to a job that's 8 to 5, 40 hours a week. And that's so far away from our deep roots of who we are. That's my fundamental understanding. And how do we combat that is wilderness, is the ability to get back into nature as much as we possibly can. And the sad thing is that we're becoming much more of an urban society. And I've lived in cities, Minneapolis and Winnipeg, Canada, and Basel, Switzerland. And so I have lots of opportunities to live in cities. And I always feel very disconnected from who I really am when I'm living in an urban environment. Wherever you are, to nourish your soul is whenever you're uncertain or stressed, is to get out with your dog on a rural road. Just take a walk with your dog and you'll come back and you'll know whether what you're feeling is an inconvenience or a tragedy.
Yeah. So you also say that dogs don't make the human distinction that we make between domesticated or wild. They just live by their nature and experience. But is that true? Because as we have become more of an urban society, we do have a lot of dogs in big buildings in New York City, and some dogs become our little babies. Do you think this is still true?
I go back to our current experience is a veneer, a thin icing on the cake of our true nature. And I think that goes for dogs too. I think take an urban dog out to a park or even farther into the wilderness, and they will be stunned and excited and overwhelmed by the smells and what they're hearing and what they're seeing. It draws them back to who they naturally are.
In your book, you're talking about, of course, this relationship. And you mentioned that some scientists assert that as our first non-human partners, it was a game changer in our lives. What do you mean by this?
That's so exciting to me. If you think about our evolutionary history with dogs, so someplace between 25,000 and 40,000 years ago, either dogs domesticated themselves or we domesticated them, and they became our first non-human partners. They were the garbage cleaners picking up scraps of food. They became the warnings of other wolves or of other humans encroaching upon us. And they became our warm companions. So think about that. 40,000 years ago, that evolved, and they've been our partners ever since. To me, that means that the animal that's curled up in your couch right now or on your lap has got this extraordinary history with us. My number one lesson is not to take that for granted.
One of the things that you say as a lesson, I think, in part two, which is called Philosophy of the Dog, is we could learn a lot from our dogs in terms of how not to get into a fight. And this I'm really interested in because especially in and around where I live, there are a lot of dogs that are very curious and trying to navigate around each other. And what makes some dogs signal and negotiate, and what makes some dogs want to fight?
I got this from Temple Grandin from her book. Part of the problem with dogs right now are dogs on leashes, because a dog on a leash can't naturally approach another dog on a leash. So that just ends up, now they're face to face, and that ends up sometimes being confrontational. But dogs from wolves have learned strategies to de-escalate, because a fight in the wild, even if you're the winner and injured, it can be a death sentence, either from bleeding out or from infection. So avoiding fights is an evolutionary strategy, except in cases of reproduction and sex, which works for us too. The best thing to do is to avoid fighting. So dogs evolved strategies. And you've seen, if you have a dog, you know the strategies. They'll be submissive. They'll roll over on their backs and expose their bellies. An aggressive strategy is they'll stand over another dog if they feel they're dominant. Their hackles will raise. And all those are warning signs that says, if we fight, this is going to be bad, so let's not fight. I was thinking as a teenager in rural Minnesota, where to fight was a natural part of the ecosystem. I wish I could have learned these, because every Friday night there was a group of boys would get together and fight. That's just what we did, with dire consequences often. But it's something that we can definitely learn from our dogs. There's no reason to get upset when somebody cuts in front of you in traffic. There's no reason to get upset when somebody cuts in front of you in a line. And all the things that cause us to be aggressive and irritated are really minor and inconsequential if you think about it. So learning from our dogs, they have strategies to avoid conflict. And I think we can come up with our own strategies to avoid conflict in our lives. And in doing so, we have a much more peaceful existence. We don't have to be the alpha all the time. That's nonsense. And we will get along in the world much better.
Do you think it's because dogs don't have egos that they can do this?
I look at Toby, and I think he does have an ego.
I know. Even as I was saying that, I was like, wait, is that true?
I think of our ego as, I need to be important. I need to be liked. I need to be right. I need to be comfortable. And all the stuff that feeds our ego. And if you look at that, all that stuff is irrational and gets in our way of being our true self. Everybody makes mistakes. Everybody's wrong. My wife points this out, Lori, all the time, that I'm wrong, she's right. And I just roll with that because it's just a happier life. So if we let go of that and realize that it helps us not be in conflict with other people, and it helps us be happier with ourselves if we let go of all that ego stuff. It's hard. It's hard. It's not easy. It's entrained in us.
Right, of course. And that's where we learn in mindfulness and Buddhist philosophy and so many at cognitive behavioral therapy. You talk a bit about anthropomorphizing. And it's interesting. I want you to talk about that and how we do that with dogs. And in a way, I think we do that with people too, although it's called stories. Someone says something to us and we make up a story about what they meant. Maybe we don't ask that next question to really understand what it is, but we're constantly creating stories in our little monkey minds. How does this sync with what you were saying in the book about anthropomorphizing?
Yes, I always talk about, we all graduated from MSU, which is the School of Making Stuff Up.
I love that.
That's how our brains are designed. I went to school in Colorado, Colorado Springs, Colorado College, and I was a psychology major. And this was back in the 70s. And at the time, anthropomorphizing was the greatest sin. To attribute human emotions to non-human species got you in so much trouble. And they took it to such a radical point of view that they might experience pain, but they can't suffer. And there are all kinds of experiments with animals that, as a mature, thoughtful dog guardian, we were never allowed to have happen to our own dogs. That's changed. The tide has shifted in terms of how we think about animals now. And one writer said, it's not about not anthropomorphizing, but it's about anthropomorphizing well. It's understanding that animals, and there's so much research now, that dogs have feelings, that dogs feel pain, that dogs can suffer. We have to think about it. We're both socially bonding mammals, and we both evolved to be in small groups. So why wouldn't we have some of the same emotions, same feelings? So it's about anthropomorphizing well. You know your dogs. You know when your dog is sad or upset or anxious, like you talked about in the elevator. You know that. And I think everybody who owns or is a dog guardian knows when their dog is upset or knows when their dog is happy. There was just this research done in Japan where they measured the amount of tears in a dog's eyes. I don't know how they did that, but they did that. And they noticed that when a dog was separated from its guardian, then met its guardian again, their eyes welled up with tears. And when humans' eyes well up with tears, it's not just a physiological reaction, it's an emotional reaction. So it's easy to extrapolate that dogs are having that same emotional reaction when they're joined again with their...
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. We talk about these often on Untangle. When we keep things bottled up inside, it can start to impact our health, mentally, emotionally, and physically. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest, whatever it is. If this sounds like you, and it's a bit of all of us, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule and needs. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/untangle. Now over to Untangle.
Guardian.
It's so interesting because I was hiking with my dog the other day and we were on leash in the beginning of the hike and I was training him to sit while two other dogs on leash were passing us. And one of the dogs that passed us got off his leash and attacked us. He jumped on us and I don't even know what happened because in those moments, you're just trying to protect your dog and I'm on the ground pushing the other dog away and my dog's yelping a little bit and it ends and there's no bites anywhere. The dog that attacked us just made really loud sounds and pushed us around but didn't bite either of us. But I was traumatized. And I called my dog trainer and I said, what can I do so that my dog won't be traumatized? And he said, you're way more traumatized than your dog. If you keep walking on the trail, your dog is going to be fine. They move on so much faster than we do. Does that fit in with some of what you're saying? I immediately thought he would feel traumatized and he actually did seem quite fine, way better than me.
Right. So I think we project our feelings on our dog. And sometimes it's correct. And sometimes dogs look at us and they mirror back our emotional state. And so we talk a lot about, and Temple Grandin talks a lot about, you can't have a calm dog if you're not calm. And if you're calm and just walk away, your dog will pick up those signals and be calm most of the time. Most of the time. Caveat, caveat.
A caveat. Hirsch, I want to ask you a question. Do you meditate? Are you a meditator?
I have tried meditation. I do yoga a lot. Mostly because I'm the stereotypical ancient athlete. And if I don't do yoga every day, I can't walk. But it is a time of reflection. What I get out of yoga is not only the physical aspects of it, but a time to reflect and breathe, focus on my breath. And my mantra, because I'm an anxious person, is saying to myself, everything's okay, everything's okay. And usually that works out, except every once in a while, Toby comes and lays on my yoga mat. And so
you're like, it's not okay.
We fight over it. It's not okay. Yeah.
Because you do talk about a concept in Buddhism called metta, which is the loving kindness practice. And you say that's your family's philosophy of how you want to treat your dogs. How do you integrate that practice into your life with your dogs? And what is that lesson?
First, I learned about metta and about loving kindness from being a firefighter. From realizing that in trauma and in situations of enormous amount of tragedy and stress, what people remember most about being a firefighter is their kindness. And I took that as and extrapolated that to how I want to show up in life. And that's where I became a beginning Buddhist, because that was the philosophy or way of thinking that was most closely aligned with what I'd learned as a firefighter. And you start out with saying, okay, I'm going to show loving kindness in my life to other humans. The simplest things to do are open doors for people, let people cut in front of you, like we talked about before, to be as empathic a listener as I possibly can be, which is really hard because we're not good listeners, but to really work on that and to work on being kind. So then the next step is saying, well, wait a minute. We live in a world of sentient beings. We live in a world of sentience, of beings who have thoughts, who have identity, who feel pain, who can suffer. And I thought about that. So how do I want to show up in that world? And it's with the same idea of loving kindness. How can I reduce my footprint? How can I be as kind and respectful to all life as I possibly can be? That is difficult. That is hard. in our culture right now. But I think it's the next step in terms of how we see ourselves.
I think loving kindness practices add so much richness to our lives and so much goodness. You also talk about these lessons of how to keep it simple. And I actually think it's similar to your statement about dogs being masters of what's important. They're filtering out all these complications, or they aren't dealing with all the complications that we as humans have in life. But there are some.
There are some. At Boston College, they have a dog cognition center, and they're working with children and dogs solving puzzles. And they notice that children will imitate adults. They'll copy the steps that I copy, that I do in solving a puzzle, even if some of those steps are irrelevant. But dogs, in terms of solving a puzzle to get to treats, will cut to the chase. They recognize what's non-essential and go right to solving the puzzle. And I thought that was a great metaphor for keeping it simple. And in the book, I talk about how growing up, we had our two daughters and we had our dogs. And we lived way back in the wilderness. And the dogs were sentinels for what our life should be, because we were always distracted. We had soccer games. We had school. We both traveled for work. And so we were always busy, 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 busy. And the dogs would look at us like, you're crazy. The most important thing is for us to be together in our little tribe, in our little family. And when there's a blizzard or a thunderstorm, why are you going to a soccer game? We should just all be at home. And they're clear messengers of that life. Now, clearly, because life is much more complicated for human beings, that sometimes we had to violate that idea. But it was always in the back of my mind that the dogs really knew what was important and what is not important. They cut to the chase.
Speaking of knowing what's important, you mentioned that dogs are comfortable in silence. So one can say, well, of course they are. They don't speak. But it's an interesting thing to think about this with human beings, like how uncomfortable we are when we're with someone else and there's silence. And sometimes the silence turns into anxiety. Sometimes it turns into this need to quickly say something that has no bearing on anything in the moment. And you were saying that in silence, with your dogs, you can just sit and be together. And that's such a lovely bit of light when you're not feeling so light. It's just so much easier to have moments of silent clarity with your dog than it is with a human.
Right. I think for good and bad reasons, our life with other humans is complicated. I think that's the word. It's complicated. And with dogs, it's a lot simpler. And sometimes so much of it is understanding that in our lives, we need time to reflect. We need time to think. We need time to just be with ourselves or be with someone we love in silence and to understand and to think about deep things, to not get carried away with the grocery list or what has to happen today, but to be able to take some time to think about, why am I here? What is my life about? Who do I love? What is my legacy? All those kinds of deeper thoughts. Those things take place in silence. They can have conversation later, but they take place in silence. And I talk about in the book, just being up in the mountains with the dogs and just watching the sky change and the light change in the mountains and just sitting there and not having to talk. And if you're an introvert like I am, it's exhausting to talk. But just to be with dogs, they sleep at your feet, they look at you, but they're comfortable in silence. They're comfortable just being. That's a huge lesson for us. To find those times to just be, and instead of having to spend the energy, which is what it feels like to engage in conversation.
Has being silent with your dogs helped you to be silent with some of the closer humans in your life?
I'm working on it.
Yeah. Good job. So I want to switch to a little bit of a darker topic, though I really love talking about this because I think it's so important in our lives. You write about how you think dogs might imagine death. I think it was Nelly, your How to Be an Old Dog and What an Old Dog Can Teach You. And what were some of Nelly's big lessons to you as she got older? And perhaps if there's another dog that inspired you in this understanding.
Sure. So Nelly was a 9-year-old Bernese Mountain Dog. And she had a rough couple of years towards the end. She had a fractured hip and she had to stay at the vets for a couple of weeks at a time to be immobilized. And then she lost her right eye to cancer. The thing about it was, when we came to pick her up at the vet, she was always happy to see us. She, even with a missing eye and a limp, she always wanted to go on walks. And so what I learned from that is that the urge to live was very strong in her. The urge to be a part of the family, no matter how much pain she might have been in. And I don't think she was in a lot of pain until later. But being disabled, I talk about it in the book about being TABS. We're all TABS, which means it stands for temporarily able-bodied. All of us face the future of death and disability. That's just the way it works. And what Nelly taught me is that we can still be a living force, if you will. We can still enjoy life. We can still participate in life, even when we're disabled, even when we're having trouble standing. That was an inspiration to me. And her tail always wagged. She always wanted to jump up on the couch, but even though we had to lift her up on the couch, and she always wanted to be with us until she passed away. Nellie was a dog that always liked to sleep outdoors, especially when there was a storm, like a blizzard. She always opted to go out to our dog door and sleep on our patio. And so one night, after she'd been diagnosed with a mass in her belly, she went out to sleep on the patio. I got up the next morning early and went out to let her in, and she had passed away in the night. And it was hard because we didn't have a chance to say goodbye, but she had passed away as an old dog under the stars. I thought, that's how I want to go. When my time comes, give me a couple blankets and just let me sleep outside under the stars.
Yeah, you wrote, to that I say yes, give me that.
Give me that.
You have a narrative by Dan Gemeinhardt called The Honest Truth, and it goes like this: dogs die, but dogs live too, right up until they die. They live. They live brave, beautiful lives. They protect their families and love us and make our lives a little brighter. And they don't waste time being afraid of tomorrow. I thought that was such a beautiful.
So beautiful.
It's just so true. Do you think that a dog knows when it's going to die?
I think so. And again, this is anthropomorphizing. So I talk about the experience I had. I was driving up to the Santa Fe ski basin up in the mountains, and I came upon a deer lying on the road. I got in my car, and the deer was clearly dead, but it just recently died because it was still warm. And it was a buck, and there were two does standing on the road watching me as I checked out their friend. And they didn't run away. They just stared. And I thought at that time that they must be thinking something, even if it's just the idea of, you're here now and then you're gone, or the tragedy of seeing the other deer being hit by a car, but they must be thinking something. And again, this is deep into anthropomorphizing, but I think dogs have an awareness of when they're healthy. Animals have an awareness of when they need to hold up, right? When they're injured or wounded. So why not would they have an understanding that there's a time when it's ending? I have no answers, but there's a lesson there. The meta lesson of the book is what Dan points towards, is that dogs have short lives. And in reality, we all have a short life. We are not here forever. I do this in Firefighter Zen, the book I wrote about firefighting. I talk about how if you do a lifeline, you create a lifeline from the day you're born to the day you're going to die. And then in the middle of that line, you put what day it is. You realize you maybe have 20, 30 years left. And that's a short amount of time. And so the question is, what are you going to do? Mary Oliver talks, what are you going to do with your wonderful, beautiful life, the rest of your days? Living with dogs, understanding that they have a short life, really reinforces that question for all of us. How do we get the joy and the fun and the purposefulness out of what we have left? Because we don't have a lot of time. Genetically, sometimes we have this thing in our brain that says we're immortal, like when we're 18, that we're going to live forever. And I think we have to disabuse ourselves of that thought and realize that we're not here for long. And we have much to do.
I interviewed Frank Ostaseski, who wrote a book called The Five Invitations, What Death Can Teach Us About Living Fully. And I feel it's very in sync with what you're saying. And the truth is, when you say 20, 30 years, the truth is we have no idea how much time we have left.
Exactly.
I thought this was funny because I'm not sure I've learned this, and I have a small dog, but you said that small dogs taught you about empathy. Was it one particular small dog, or are you making a general statement?
No, it was about Maisie. She's all of 12 pounds and she's ferocious, but one day we were walking along a road, and our road goes through high desert prairie. And I thought, what is Maisie experience? So I lay down on the road and looked into the tall grasses. I thought, oh my God, I can't see over the tall grasses. How does she manage that? I can see over things. I can see the horizon, but she's stuck being able to see up to the edge of the road and not beyond. And I said, no wonder she's always cautious about sniffing around the grass before she goes into the grass. And I thought that was a great lesson taught to me about trying to perceive the world through somebody else's eyes. We don't understand what somebody else is seeing, experiencing, or feeling. And we have to really take the time to ask questions and to be empathic to understand how they perceive the world. It's this idea, if you come from the point of view that I have my perspective, which is only my perspective, and everybody else has a different perspective. And if you understand that and practice that, it becomes automatic to be more empathic.
Absolutely. How did your dogs teach you about resilience? This was a big part of your book.
Our preconception had been that how a dog is raised in the first 3 months of life really put in stone how they were going to turn out as older dogs. And although I think that's significantly true, when we adopted both Maisie and Toby, they were both had been shelter dogs, or Maisie had been a street dog living on the street. And Maisie, I think, is the best example of that, because my daughter found her on the street, and after some negotiation, because she already had a dog and a cat, so we ended up taking Maisie for her. But Maisie was scared. She was thin. She would growl at us. She would sit on the couch and just shake. And we just decided to be patient. And she slowly came around to being friendly, to sleeping on our beds. She never lost her ability to be irritated, but she became a friendly, warm, and fun dog to be with. And what that taught me was that rescue dogs, they need routine, they need patience, they need exercise, they need kind words. And if you give them that, they're resilient. They will bounce back. They will become healthy dogs. And the same with Toby, who was, when he came to our house, he did a 360 around the house. He went out in the yard, did a 360 around the yard, then just went to the farthest part of the yard and laid down. It didn't want to have anything to do with us. And again, we said, okay, we're going to be patient. We're going to feed him. We're going to take care of him. And within a couple of months, he was on our beds, on our couch. When we go on walks, he stays right by my side. So it was that same thing, that the dogs are resilient. They will bounce back. It doesn't always work, but we can be optimistic about giving a dog a chance if we're patient.
How old is Toby now?
We don't know. We think he's like 4.
Oh, okay. Still young.
4 or 5.
So I have 2 more things I want to ask you. There are a lot of really lovely messages from this book. Is there anything else that you in particular want to share with us from the book?
The thing that is most important to me is to not take our dogs for granted, to understand that this is an extraordinary gift we're given that comes from 25,000 years of coevolution to this point where dogs are in our homes, living with us and part of our lives. And once you come to understand that special history and that special relationship, it's really hard to take a dog for granted, and that they need things. They need to be with us. You have to decide for yourself how long you can leave a dog alone before it's too long and before they're going to act out. And you have to make sometimes changes to your lifestyle, which goes against the grain because we think dogs should just fit into our lifestyle. But I think we have to make adjustments to our lifestyle if we're going to truly enjoy the presence of a dog in our life. So that's an important lesson.
I'm glad you shared that. And then I want to ask you something that I ask all my guests of late is, what are 3 pieces of advice that you would give your younger self?
Wow.
Get a dog.
Get a dog. Yeah. I've thought about that before. And I think my first one is there's no such thing as failure. There's just learning. On the counterpoint to that, you make choices in your life that open up doors but close other doors. And you have to be thoughtful about that. You have to be thoughtful about what you're doing. The third thing is, it's about love, is that there's not a finite amount of love in you, that the more love you give and the more love you receive, the more there is inside you to express. So those would be my 3 things.
Those are great. Hirsch, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and the wisdom of your dogs. I'm very grateful that you were able to be with us today.
Well, thanks, Patricia. It's been a fun hour. Very much fun.
Thanks for joining today. You can get a copy of Dog Lessons wherever you get your books. Check out choosemuse.com/meditation studio to get hundreds of free meditations. As always, if you have comments, questions, or suggestions, please reach out at untangle@choosemuse.com. Have a great week, and we will see you next time.